You're listening to Veep, The Life and Times of Alvin Barkley. I'm Todd Hatton. Whatever else you could call Alvin Barkley, congressman, senator, vice president, gramps, he was definitely a storyteller. It was how he got things done, the tool he used to communicate the complexities of government to his constituents and policy to his colleagues. I mean, he even called his memoir, That Reminds Me. So it makes sense to look at his life and his career in those terms. And the one story about him that most people know is a pretty powerful one. April 30th, 1956, Barkley gives the keynote to a packed Washington and Lee mock convention. His speech builds to this paraphrase of Psalm 84.
For I would rather be a servant in the house of the Lord than to sit in the seats of the mighty.
Then he falls, struck down by a heart attack. It's where most accounts of his life start. At the end. It's an incredible story, the circumstances so fitting that it sounds a little contrived if you'd read it in a novel. But it doesn't tell us much. It doesn't account for all the statues, landmarks, and plaques. Yes, he was Kentucky's longest-serving U.S. Senator until Mitch McConnell. And yes, he was Harry Truman's vice president. But does that explain all the tributes after he died? In a word, no. In seven, it doesn't even begin to explain it. And here's a better story. One that sheds far more light on the man and his significance. It's the Veep himself telling journalist Sidney Shalit about the time he stood on a principle, a move that may have cost him the presidency in 1944.
Well, here's what happened. We were in the middle of the war at that time, and we realized that we could not tax the people sufficiently to raise all the expenses of the war, but we were anxious, and he was too, to raise just as much as was possible in taxation. So that we wouldn't have to borrow any more than was necessary.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt has asked Congress for a $10 billion tax increase to help fight World War II. And he's tasked his Big Four, Vice President Henry Wallace, House Speaker Sam Rayburn, House Majority Floor Leader John McCormick, and Senate Majority Leader Alvin Barkley with getting it done. All they can manage is a bill raising some $2.8 billion.
I recommend that the Congress adopt, first, a realistic and simpler tax law, which will tax all unreasonable profits, both individual and corporate, and reduce the ultimate cost of the war to our sons and daughters. The tax bill now under consideration by the Congress does not begin to meet this test.
And he tells congressional leaders he's considering a veto.
I was somewhat surprised that he indicated he might veto the bill. And I said, well, this is all we can do, and if you veto this bill, you won't get another tax bill.
In particular, Barkley tells Roosevelt that since he can't get the loaf of bread he wants, he should be thankful for the comparative crust he can get. Still, on February 22nd, FDR does veto the measure, saying, it is a relief bill providing relief not for the needy, but for the greedy. It has been suggested that I should give my approval on the ground that having asked Congress for a loaf of bread to take care of this war, I should be content with a small piece of crust. I might have done so if I had not noted that the small piece of crust contained so many extraneous and inedible materials.
Well, that language offended me very deeply because I had been a loyal supporter of his whole program. And I believed in the program because I was a liberal and a progressive long before I ever heard of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
That is an understatement. One observer calls Alvin's reaction to the message a cold fury. It isn't hard to see why Alvin might take this a bit personally. Roosevelt calls out Barkley's loaves and crust comment while all but accusing the majority leader and Congress of passing a bill benefiting the rich at the poor's expense during a world war. Considering all Alvin's worked for, it's probably this last bit that stings the most. But there's a lot more going on here. Alvin Barkley and Franklin Roosevelt aren't just political allies, they're friends. And they've been friends since 1920, when Alvin was a four-term congressman running for his fifth, and Franklin was the vice presidential candidate on the doomed Democratic ticket that year. It was an odd friendship. They were kindred political spirits from very different backgrounds. Franklin was the cousin of a U.S. president and the scion of a patrician New York family. Alvin, on the other hand, was the son of a Graves County farmer, born on November 24, 1877, in a log cabin, just like his hero, Abraham Lincoln. Of course, I should mention that it was his grandfather's two-story log cabin.
And you got up to that second story through a stairway, over a stairway, that went up on an open terrace porch. It didn't go up on the inside of the house.
Nevertheless, Albin knew what poverty looked like. The rapid changes in the steam-powered Gilded Age United States hadn't yet filtered down to the farms of western Kentucky, where even a boy's work was as hard as it had ever been.
From the time I was 10 years old until I was 16 or 18 years old, I split as many, if not more, rails than Abraham Lincoln ever split. I accepted it as a part of the duty of a young man raised on the farm, and fact business, I rather enjoyed the experience of plowing. There's a sort of a thrill that comes to a barefooted boy in plowing up ground and turning it over and stepping into the fresh furrow with his bare feet. And with all that, and with my country associates and my schoolmates and the fun we had in the family made me rather enjoy the farm and the farm work.
You can believe that or not, but let me introduce you to someone who can paint a perhaps more believable picture of a bright and, well, occasionally mischievous boy, someone who knows Barkley.
I know Alvin Barkley because he was my grandfather.
Washington, D.C. attorney Stephen Truitt.
One particular story I remember was when he was left, he was the oldest, he was left to take care of the baby, and he dressed up and put blackface all over himself, all over his face, a burnt cork. When the rest of the family went out in a buggy to go someplace, but they returned early, much earlier than he had suspected they would, and the baby was wailing, having been totally frightened by this this apparition. Well, this led to a sound thrashing by his father. And although it was a Sunday, he was directed to go out and hoe the corn. And he told the story about how he said, "Well, I'm going to hoe so hard that I'll die. Then they'll miss me."
Well, he didn't die, but he did conclude his life's work lie elsewhere, deciding to study law after graduating from the Methodist-run Marvin College in Clinton, Kentucky in 1897. He worked his way through school as a janitor, inspiring a later Clinton businessman to put a sign on the old Marvin dormitory reading, "Barkley swept here." There was something else he decided. You see, he wasn't born Albin William Barkley.
Well, I had two uncles. Both of them were called Willie. And when I was born, my parents named me Willie Albin. I went by the name of Willie Albin until I got old enough to realize, as I thought, that that was an awkward name, and I was never called Willie. It was incongruous for me, it seemed, even as a boy, robust and strong as I was, to go around with the name of Willie attached to me. So I changed it.
Name change aside, Albin had always been something of a progressive. Back in the pre-highway department days, when the county required private citizens to serve on crews maintaining county roads, he worked alongside people of all classes, creeds, and colors, developing a knowledge and an understanding of the struggles they faced. He knew how hard their lives were, and he came to believe, to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, that government of the people, by the people, and for the people, well, it ought to be able to do something for them.
In my 40 years of public life in Washington, I have advanced that theory over the opposition of a great many people who believe in just standing still, that Uncle Sam or the government ought to be hitched to a post, that government and politics itself ought to stand still. Well, now the people don't believe that, and I don't believe it.
Barkley's grandson, Stephen Truitt.
What he was in favor of was having an active federal government doing the things that could not otherwise be done by any state government, but which needed to be done for the general welfare and the people, and not simply tending a large group of federal employees who were sitting back and doing nothing. He wanted to see, as he put it, Uncle Sam roll up his sleeves and start doing stuff.
And that notion came with him when he arrived in Washington as 1st District U.S. Congressman-elect in 1913, following an unusual and hard-fought campaign. Albin had defeated Paducah lawyer and former Congressman John Hendrick, who just happened to be his former boss.
Now, he rather resented the fact that I, as his stenographer a few years before, was bold enough to run for Congress. And he thought that he ought to go back to Congress instead of me, just a mere boy. And I'd worked for him at $12 a month salary. Who was this upstart who's trying to go to Congress?
Hendrick tried to use Albin's ambition against him, telling voters that if they sent him to the House, it wouldn't be long before he went after a Senate seat. Hendrick thought he'd played a trump card. What he'd actually done was underestimate Barkley's skill and talent for connecting with people. Big mistake.
I said, well, it is true that I was elected prosecuting attorney here and judge, for which I'm grateful. And it is true that I'm ambitious enough to want to go to Congress. If I weren't, I wouldn't be a candidate. And I said, if after I'm elected to Congress, I see a senatorship lying around loose and looks like it's as easy to get as this race is, I may run for that.
It was an honest answer, and the voters approved. But that was something he already had a reputation for, dating back to when he decided to attend Emory College in Georgia. To raise tuition, he sold crockery, guaranteed not to crack under heat. He worked Southern Graves County on a hired black horse, and he was good at it. On his first circuit, he made all the money he needed. The second time, well, he found a lot of irate housewives. The guaranteed crockery did crack in the heat, but Barkley made good on all of the losses and out of his own pocket. He said later he ended up with a deficit approximating the cost of the horse he rode in on. Albin also ended up remembered by these housewives as that honest young man who kept his word. So they encouraged their husbands to send him to Washington.
When I was a schoolboy, I had read the lives of Henry Clay and Gladstone and many other great men of our country and other nations, and I had a desire to serve the public. Of course, it's always hazardous to start out to do that because the people can cut you off any time they want to. But in my case, the people have been generous, and I have made it a lifetime profession.
Again, it's important to point out that the generosity that allowed him to make his lifetime profession was, in large measure, the response to that knack he had for connecting with people, even if, as Stephen Truett tells it, he didn't know he was doing it.
When he was a freshman congressman, he had been a courtroom reporter before, and he learned a form of shorthand called Pittman, which is rather difficult to learn, but it's very fast. Wilson invited all of the freshman congressmen to the White House, and he saw my grandfather taking notes in Pittman, and he called him over. He said, I know Pittman too. Who are you? So that's how he met Wilson.
That's President Woodrow Wilson, and it carried over to his fellow legislators. A people person, you might say. Stephen Truett agrees. He says whether or not you agreed with his grandfather, you probably still liked him.
Well, he was particularly gregarious, and he liked people. And he even liked his political opponents, by and large, with the exception of Mr. Chandler, perhaps.
That's Kentucky Governor, U.S. Senator, and groundbreaking Major League Baseball Commissioner A.B. Chandler. More on him in a bit.
And I'll give an example of that, which I learned purely by accident from a neighbor who happened to be the son of Senator Taft of Ohio.
Longtime Republican Senator Robert Taft.
Senator Taft was a somewhat prickly individual, and he was the majority leader when my grandfather was the minority leader in the do-nothing 80th Congress. And at that time, my grandmother was quite ill, and my grandfather took speaking engagements for which he was paid, and his colleague across the aisle, Bob Taft, would get opportunities that Mr. Taft did not wish to take up, and he would immediately recommend Albin to whoever was asking about it as a substitute and said, I know he's a Democrat, but they'll love him.
Now just try imagining that happening today. Barkley's clash with Roosevelt comes to its crescendo, and the Iron Man defies the political odds when Veep, The Life and Times of Albin Barkley, returns. You're listening to Veep, The Life and Times of Albin Barkley. I'm Todd Hatton. Here, Albin is in 1944, Majority Leader of the United States Senate, a powerful and influential man, caught short by an accusatory veto message from an old friend he'd worked hard to support. Barkley has put in a lot of hours crafting and shepherding New Deal legislation through a Congress that wasn't always, or even often, all that willing to pass it. And the airtime and stump speeches he's given promoting the New Deal is second only to Roosevelt himself. And to turn around and get this? What does he do now? Barclay's friend and colleague, Georgia Democratic Senator Walter George.
Senator Barclay, on the morning of the veto message, asked me as chairman or acting chairman of the Finance Committee to withhold the veto message until he could prepare a text indicating that he expected to speak to the veto message.
So Albin goes home. He tries to sleep on it. It doesn't work. He ends up pacing the floor, agonizing over what to do, what to say most of the night. Finally, he goes to see his wife, Dorothy. Heart disease has confined her to her bed, but it hasn't dulled her wits, and he needs her counsel. When Albin met the pretty and sophisticated Dorothy Brower back in Paducah, he was smitten. And when the family, including Dorothy, moved to Tiptonville, Tennessee, he racked up the railroad miles to see her before they married in 1905. They'd been partners ever since. Again, Stephen Truitt.
She was very warm and very friendly, but she also had a way of asking you questions, the way grandmothers sometimes can, that made you want to do the right thing. She had a way of doing this, even over the telephone, which I regarded as usually a safe form of communication. She would ask something like, "Now, are you being nice to your mother and minding her?" And, "Oh," you said, "yes, yes, Granny." And thereafter, you started minding her.
As Albin and Dorothy talk, it becomes clear what he should do and how serious it is. He must go before the Senate, rebut the veto message, and resign as majority leader, all to preserve his integrity and the integrity of the U.S. Congress. But this is Franklin Delano Roosevelt we're talking about here, arguably one of the most powerful presidents in American history, and he does not forget when people cross him. Then again, Albin does have some experience with tough political opponents, like in 1938, when Happy Chandler happened. Chandler's grandson, former U.S. Congressman Ben Chandler, explains.
My grandfather decided to challenge Barclay for the Senate, and they ran against each other in a primary. Barclay, of course, took a very dim view of that. You had the sitting governor running against the majority leader of the Senate in a Democratic primary. Now, nothing like that has really happened that I'm aware of in American history.
And it got a little ugly. Chandler was much younger than Barclay, and Barclay biographer James Libby says the governor tried to make hay out of that. It didn't work.
Happy Chandler, he had some water that he claimed was poisoned when he was at a hotel in Louisville, and he blamed the Barclay group for poisoning him. And unfortunately, in terms of Chandler, his entourage admitted that for 4 or 5 days before he had this experience with this poisoned water, quote-unquote, he had been having some severe stomach problems. Subsequently, some body fluids were taken from him. They were tested at a laboratory, and they didn't find any poison.
Barclay used a little political jujitsu here. When giving a speech, he'd reach down for the glass of water on the podium, hold it up, inspect it, then shudder and sit it back down. The crowd ate it up. So much for the issue of Albin's age. Then there was the issue of who Roosevelt endorsed. Ben Chandler.
My grandfather always supported Roosevelt, but he came into the state in favor of Barclay because Barclay had done a lot for him. He ended up doing a lot with Roosevelt while he was governor, despite Roosevelt being for Barclay and being close to Barclay. But there are famous pictures from that race when Roosevelt came to campaign for Barclay, one at Latonia Racetrack in northern Kentucky in particular. Barclay's sitting in the car, Roosevelt's sitting in the car, and my grandfather hops in, sits right between them, and with a big smile. And Roosevelt, like he always did, was smiling, and Barclay had the sourest look on his face you ever saw, and I don't blame him.
But that didn't help Chandler either. Barclay carried 74 out of Kentucky's 120 counties. James Libby says the governor later came to terms with that.
Chandler himself, in his autobiography, admitted that Barclay would have been elected no matter who would run against him in 1938.
But this is 1944, and bear in mind, this is an election year. As Albin pours his heart and mind out to Dorothy, they're both aware that Albin is very high on a very short list of vice presidential candidates. They both know this could cost him dearly.
And she said, "Go to it. I'm with you." I went to my office, and I dictated my speech, and 12 o'clock came before it was half transcribed on the typewriter, and I wanted to get recognition at once at 12 o'clock. I think I had about 6 or 7 pages of it when I went over. And I said to my secretary, I said, you send this over just as fast as you get a page ready, because I may run out.
Around noon, Barkley arrives in a very tense Senate chamber. He takes his front row seat. Looking around, he notices that the room is packed. Everyone knows something's going down. Finally, he rises, is recognized, and begins to speak.
And in the middle of it, I was about to run out of paper when I had almost exhausted these 5, 6, or 7 pages I took with me. Senator McKellar of Tennessee, who sat next to me in the Senate, was there, and I said to McKellar, Mac, go out there in the cloakroom and call my office and see if there's some more of that speech coming over here. I'm nearly out. He rushed out into the cloakroom, and in about a half a minute, he came back with 2 more sheets. And all during the rest of the delivery of that speech, he was my messenger boy back and forth, going out to get what had been sent over until the last sheet came over.
For 45 minutes, Barkley refutes Roosevelt's veto message, point by point. Then he says,
I am deeply grateful for all the honors that have been conferred upon me by the people of Kentucky, by the United States Senate, and by the President. But there are 2 things more precious to me than any of these: the rectitude of my conscience and my self-respect. I have today tried to maintain them both.
He then calls for a caucus meeting to tender his resignation, urges the Senate to override the veto, which it does, and sits down.
And after it was all over with, the Senate had arisen and given me a tremendous ovation, Democrats and Republicans. McKellar shouted, I forgive him of everything he ever did, just like that.
The ovation is a signal to Roosevelt that his veto is going down, and to Barkley that he won't be a former majority leader for very long. Senate Democrats, to a man, vote him back to the post. One says, when he was first elected leader, the impression was given that he spoke to us for the president. Now that he has been unanimously elected, he speaks for us to the president. As for Franklin and Albin,
I felt in my heart that he never quite forgave me for my opposition, and probably for the language I used in analyzing and refuting the statements that he'd made in his veto. And I'm saying what I'm said, have said, in the utmost friendly feeling and good faith. There's no touch of bitterness, disappointment, or resentment in my heart over anything that happened between Roosevelt and me, and I cherish for him a very beautiful memory.
Barkley biographer Dr. James Libby believes Albin's name came off that short list in the aftermath, and for a reason that sounds pretty flimsy.
Roosevelt claimed that Barkley at that point in time was already too old and so forth, but it was a lame excuse. I mean, considering the ages of various, you know, politicians at that point in time. I do feel that he let him go because of what happened with the tax element. For quite some months after that particular issue happened, the two men barely saw each other and really didn't have comfortable conversations with each other.
Harry Truman, the guy FDR did pick to run with him in 1944, was just 6 years younger than Barkley. Either way, when Roosevelt dies suddenly on April 12, 1945, he will not be succeeded by a President Albin W. Barkley. Now think about that. Albin once half-jokingly told Dorothy that he'd take her to the White House one day as First Lady. He wanted to be president. He'd put in the time, the work. He'd served his president, his party, and most importantly to Albin, his people. But this veto message had pushed him, and Congress, too far. I mean, what would you do? What kind of person, what kind of politician does something like this? The kind that sets aside any bruises to his ego and his ambition to renominate Roosevelt in 1944 and campaign for his victory. The kind that offers encouragement and advice to the man who succeeds FDR, Harry S. Truman. In his first months in office, Truman was self-deprecating to the point where he actually told reporters he wished he'd never become president. Barkley thought it was too much and said so.
Mr. President, I realize how you feel about this job. But you've got it. You're president of the United States. God raises up leaders. We do not know the process, but in the providence of Almighty God, you have been made president of the United States. But I think you ought to have confidence in yourself. If you don't have confidence in your own ability to guide this country, the people will lose confidence in you. You've got to lead the nation out of this war in Europe and in Asia, and you can do it.
And Truman will do it. But first, it will fall to Barclay to literally write a chapter of world history, one of its darkest. The war in Europe is coming to its conclusion, and stories are filtering in from the Eastern Front, stories of camps whose sole purpose is the destruction of European Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, and other people the Nazis have deemed subhuman. The Allies don't believe them at first, until the Americans liberate Buchenwald on April 11, 1945. Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower cables Army Chief of Staff General George Marshall.
He wanted a congressional delegation to come over and look at the camps, basically because no one will believe it if they don't see it. 2 days later, 3 days later, they went. My grandfather headed a delegation of about eight people from the House and the Senate. The first place they went was Buchenwald, which had been liberated for a while. And there were some doubters in the group. Some people who still thought, you know, Germans wouldn't do anything so reprehensible as this. They arrived at Dachau about an hour and a half after it had been liberated, when the crazy stuff was still going on with American soldiers machine gunning guards, German guards throwing off their uniforms and getting into prisoners' clothes, and so on and so forth. And it was obvious to everybody, including the congressional delegation, this was not something that had been cooked up by the American army. At which point, the doubters amongst them said, well, go ahead and write it up any way you want, Alvin, we'll sign it.
Atrocities and Other Conditions at Concentration Camps in Germany runs 18 pages. It's a foundational document in Holocaust scholarship. There's this photograph, taken at Buchenwald, of Albin standing over the corpses of murdered human beings stacked like cordwood. The look on his face is one of horror, near disbelief, and something close to shame. Still, Barclay concluded the report with these hopeful words, his belief that out of it all, justice will emerge, and that through the sickening spectacle which we have witnessed of the degradation to which human beings have been subjected, will ultimately come a firmer realization that men of all nations and all tongues must resist encroachments of every theory and every ideology that debases mankind, and that a more just and enduring peace may arise upon the ruins and from the sacrifices which the human race has endured through one of the most crucial periods of its history. In 1948, everybody thought Harry Truman was done. Republicans won control of Congress in the 1946 elections. Polls showed the American public wasn't all that wild about Harry, and Democrats were facing a split in the party over civil rights. According to the conventional wisdom, it would be a cakewalk to the White House for Republican Thomas Dewey. So when the Democrats gather in Philadelphia for the National Convention, it seems less like a celebration and more like a wake. They haven't counted on now three-time keynote speaker, Albin Barclay.
Republican nominee has announced with characteristic finality that he proposes to sweep from the government at Washington the cobwebs as he swept them from Albany following long tenure of Democratic administration. I am not an expert in cobwebs, but if my memory does not betray me, when the Democratic Party took over the government 16 years ago, even the spiders were too weak from starvation to weave or spin a cobweb in any department of the government of the United States.
His words re-energized the delegates. Now Albin's name is being floated as a contender for vice president. Truman wants Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas.
There was some skepticism about whether there was a chance to win or not. And a great many people, of course, were considered for the second place on the ticket. And Senator Barclay expressed his views and said that he was perfectly willing to take a chance because he thought we were going to win. And then I said to the members of the party at the convention, Go ahead and nominate Senator Barkley. With the two of us, we can win.
Now the delegates name their vice presidential candidate by acclamation. And Chairman Rayburn announces...
There's Alvin W. Barkley of Kentucky, the Democratic nominee for Vice President of the United States.
President Truman takes up the challenge in a fighting acceptance speech.
I accept the nomination. Senator Barkley and I will win this election and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that.
President Truman was wrong about just one thing. The Republicans didn't like it.
This is NBC Television.
We have obtained the results from the state of Ohio, which assures victory for President Truman and Senator Barkley. With Ohio's 25 electoral votes, President Truman and Senator Barkley will have a total of 266 votes in the Electoral College. This is the minimum figure necessary for victory.
Alvin Barkley of Kentucky, a member of Congress for 36 years, has taken his vice presidential oath of office.
So help me God.
The only two people unsurprised by this historic upset are the two men taking their oaths on January 20th, 1949. You see, at the convention, Truman promised to call a special session of Congress, and he challenged the GOP to enact its agenda. He did. They didn't. Harry and Alvin toured the country, Harry by train and Alvin by airplane, the first American politician to do so. They campaigned relentlessly, tarring the special session as the do-nothing Congress. It paid off. And the Chicago Tribune is still smarting over it. Dewey defeats Truman, read their headline the day after the election. Too soon, guys. Too soon. Just ahead, becoming the Veep and finding love in Washington. I'm Todd Hatton, and you're listening to Veep, the life and times of Alvin Barkley. You're listening to Veep, the life and times of Alvin Barkley. I'm Todd Hatton. At the front gate of Mount Kenton Cemetery in Paducah, where Alvin Barkley lies, a bronze historical marker bears a word that, out of context, looks kind of funny. Unless, of course, you watch a lot of HBO.
And the Emmy goes to... Veep!
This is the fourth consecutive nomination for Veep in the comedy series category. Veep received 9 nominations this year, winning 4 tonight. Accepting the Emmy on behalf of the team is Armando Iannucci.
You don't usually hear the word Veep said that often outside of Paducah. At least it's in the dictionary. Merriam-Webster, look it up. This all begs the question, though, where did it come from? A 10-year-old boy, that's where. By the time Alvin became vice president, Dorothy, his wife and partner of over 40 years, had finally succumbed to the heart disease that kept her bedridden in her final days. And with the kids grown and out of the house, he liked to spend time while in D.C. with family.
One night I was out at my daughter's, Mrs. Max Truitt, and she has 4 rather alert, inquisitive, and positive boys. And the youngest, Stephen. This kid says to me why, he said, "Gramps, VP stands for vice president. Why not put two little E's in there between those two big letters and call it Veep?" And then I told this story about this grandson, and they sent that story all over the United States, and from that time on, it was the Veep.
And the 10-year-old's opinion?
It was just an accident.
Here's another story. It's a quick one, but one that will surely make you smile. It seems that even the 35th vice president of the United States never forgot that he was a grandfather. Or in Stephen Truitt's case, Gramps.
So he was around all the time, and he would be at family dinners, and we would talk about anything we wanted to. We played games. including some which, if you got the wrong answer, you became a third of a pig, and then two-thirds of a pig, and then a full pig. And if you were a full pig, you had to eat some of the meal underneath the table, which occasionally my grandfather did.
Now, while you're picturing Alvin Barkley having dinner under the table, here's something else to think about. Biographer James Libby says this same human touch made the Veep extremely popular and far outside the Truitt dining room.
Look magazine did a popularity poll Look magazine was a very popular magazine at that point in time in the 1940s. And Barclay came in second. The person who came in first was Dwight David Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, who had, of course, led the Allies in victory in World War II in Europe.
And Truman knew to bring that popularity and Barclay's legislative experience to his table. For the first time, the president included the vice president in his cabinet meetings and in the new National Security Council. Despite what some might say, namely that Richard Nixon was the first modern vice president, it was actually Alvin Barclay.
One of the reasons why I describe him as the first working vice president, unlike a number of other more recent vice presidents, he actually spent a lot of time in the Senate. Of course, the vice president is the presiding officer in the Senate. But most of the time, the VP doesn't show up unless there's some kind of close vote, and the vice president can do something about that. But if you look at the papers between Barclay and Truman, it's just absolutely incredible the amount of conversations that they had, the amount of writing that they shared back and forth. Barclay was Truman's person in terms of Congress. It was very important, and that's why he ended up at all cabinet meetings, because he knew exactly what was happening in Congress and what they could do, what they couldn't do. And so this is why, really, I can describe him as the first working vice president.
But it wasn't all work. Presidential advisor Clark Clifford and his wife Marnie gave a party on the presidential yacht for a friend of theirs, an attractive 37-year-old widow from St. Louis, Missouri, named Jane Hadley. Marnie tells the story.
As Alvin walked across the gangplank, he looked at Jane, who was sitting on the fantail of the boat, and said, "Who is that beautiful woman?" And I said, "This is Mrs. Hadley, an old friend from St. Louis." And he left me like a shot and went over and sat beside Jane, where he remained like a mustard plaster all evening. But the next morning, the phone rang at about 8:15, and I recognized Alvin's voice. I said, "Alvin, I never lost a feller any faster than I lost you last night."
Jane says she found Alvin polite and cordial. She was also a little intimidated, but not by Alvin.
"First of all, I was scared because I thought I'd probably call him the wrong thing. Mr. Vice President is a rather big mouthful, but I managed pretty well for the evening for a country girl."
Or for a country boy. And on November 18, 1949, just a few days shy of Alvin's 72nd birthday, they became husband and wife. Alvin really didn't think anybody would notice.
5,000 romantic citizens race to see the Veep take a wife at St. John's Methodist Church in St. Louis. The 71-year-old vice president's bride is Mrs. Carlton Hadley, 38-year-old widow. After saying their Methodist I wills in a private 7-minute ceremony, Mr. and Mrs. Barclay received the congratulations of the crowd. It's the first time an American vice president has ever married while in office. America's new second lady and her husband go through the traditional family portrait and cake-cutting rituals. Like any newlyweds, they aren't divulging honeymoon plans, but the Veep admits...
"We hope to be back in Washington in time for the second session of the 81st Congress on the 3rd day of January, and in the meantime, no comment."
"All good pictures wind up with a happy ending and a kiss. How about that?"
"No, no kisses. We'll reserve that till later."
"That's awful fresh."
After a leisurely honeymoon, it was back to work. As Senate President, Barclay was Truman's point man in that chamber, facilitating Truman's fair deal, as he'd once done with Roosevelt's New Deal. Then it was back on the campaign trail for the 1950 midterms. At least, it was until...
June 25th, 1950. It was still dark. 4 o'clock on a Sunday morning. The Communists, made bold by months of small-scale raiding across the 38th parallel, had finally launched their undeclared all-out war of conquest.
A little over a year later, Alvin and Jane went to Korea, both to see the United Nations war effort against the Communist North and to check in on the ongoing peace talks. Keeping Jane at a safe distance, Alvin went to the front to speak and eat with the American troops there.
Vice President Barclay and Mrs. Barclay returned to Washington in a snowstorm after an extensive tour of Japan and Korea. After a first-hand inspection of the fighting front, Mr. Barclay holds hope for the current negotiations for a truce, despite the present stalemate.
"There is still haggling and still wrangling, but I still feel
that our negotiators have exhibited patience and tolerance and forbearance with the dilatory tactics of those with whom they are compelled to negotiate. Notwithstanding all this, there will be a truce signed.
But it wouldn't be until 1954, under another president, before the Korean War would, well, not technically end, since no peace treaty was ever signed, but at least pause, a pause that's still, for now, in place. And no, that other president was not Alvin. You see, with Truman's blessing and support, Barkley threw his hat into the ring for the 1952 Democratic presidential nomination. He may have thought it was a long time in coming, but some Democrats and some among his old labor allies thought it was too long. The VP was, after all, 74 with failing eyesight, and he had been having problems with his heart. The nomination will go to a distant cousin of Alvin's, though, through his mother's side, Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson. But Alvin will have the chance to speak to the convention. Some would say it was his greatest speech. He was not a candidate, he told the delegates, for any office they could nominate him for.
I am therefore in somewhat the situation of the country gentleman who for many years had gone to his county seat every Saturday in his farm wagon drawn by two mules. On all of these occasions, he came home intoxicated. He had a gentle pair of mules. They knew the way home. They drove the wagon home, drove up into the lot gate, and stopped in front of the house. Each night, the boys would go out and unhitch the team and take it to the barn and take the old gentleman in and put him to bed. On one of these Saturday nights, the boys unhitched the team, took it to the barn, but left their father in the wagon bed. As the sun came up, he aroused himself. He went to the front of the wagon and looked out over the tongue and saw no mules. He went to the rear and looked out over the wagon at the hind gate and saw no mules. He went again to the front and looked out over the muleless tongue and then said to himself, I've either lost a damn good pair of mules or I've found a damn good wagon.
And that's when he let him have it.
I am proud to have been given the opportunity by the American people to play a humble part in that great work. And whether I ever hold another office or whether I shall retire to the shades and shadows of private life, I shall carry to my dying day the cherished memory of that program. And so long as I shall breathe the breath of life, I shall fight for these things in which I believe and you believe and for which the American people believe.
There he was on the platform telling stories again.
I have been interested all my life in races of one kind or another. And I have been indulging in them ever since I was old enough to vote or to run for office, which is an identical term. As a matter of fact, in order to be here, I interrupted one of the loveliest honeymoons in which I've ever indulged. Which was the culmination of one of the fastest races I've ever run at all.
Mrs. Alban W. Barkley.
He loved his country. He loved his country. He loved the people of this country. He liked to get out among the people. It was his whole life. It really was. And he felt proud that he had devoted his life to the people of the country. So often here in Washington, I remember, we used to become alarmed perhaps by some of the headlines in the papers. And my husband would always say, now, I'm not going to worry about this until I get out among the people. You go out to Iowa and you sit on a rail fence and you talk to a farmer who may be plowing his cornfield. You find him calm. You find him with good intelligence, good opinions about what's going on in the world. He's just not worried.
Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt.
I think the vice president had a gift of staying young and making himself understood by both young and old. I hope that we will not forget his great services to his country, and particularly that those who remember him as he was when he served in the Senate will keep his memory alive for the younger generations.
Harry S. Truman.
He had a personality that made people like him. He knew how to get along with people. He knew how to take a stand also. And when he took a stand, nobody could budge him from that stand. And that's one of the reasons I was very fond of him, because he liked people, he liked to do things for people, but when he made up his mind, that was it. And of course, that's all that makes a good politician. He's got to have principles and stick by them.